So, welcome to Office Hour. It's 5 o'clock on Tuesday. And before we begin, I want to remind you that the views that are contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. You're listening to 90.3 KDVS. And as always, at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, we go out for Office Hour. I'm Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we knock on a door somewhere on campus. You can hear me. There I go. I'm knocking. I'm knocking on a door, finding out all of the fascinating things that go on campus, what faculty and students are researching, what they're thinking about, what ideas are keeping them up late at night, what they dream about, what they imagine themselves, problems that they're solved, texts they want to study, all of that. So, and I'm very pleased today we're going to knock on a pretty exciting door today. Here, we're going to be talking with Tiffany Jo Wirth from the English department about exciting things like stones, alchemy, and our place in nature. So right away, I want to welcome you to Office Hour.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right. So we're going to be talking about early modern and also some about ancient and maybe also some about present day ideas about alchemy and the place of humans in the natural world. But before we begin with Tiffany Jo Wirth's particular research projects, we're going to do what we always do, which is we're going to start off just finding out. I can't imagine that someone just wakes up one morning and wants to become a specialist in early modern alchemy. That just seems like... So how did you end up here talking about stones and early modern London?
Well, the journey has not been straightforward. It has been one paved with many different sort of crooks and turns along the way. But I suppose it began where most literature professors begin, which is with a love of reading. And I would rather have my nose in a book than doing almost anything else. And the kinds of stories that always sort of drew me to them were the stories that we might now call fantasy stories, stories of, in my period, in the early modern period in England, we might have called the romance. And these are stories that are filled with supernatural events, dragons and knights and ladies and wandering hermits. And a lot of these stories are interested in and feature, so I guess we might call them now more than human life forms and creatures. And so I just always had a real interest in the ways that creatures and narratives and stories can shapeshift.
Mm-hmm. Are there some that you remember as being particularly important to you when you were young? I mean, do you think that there were certain stories that really stood out in your mind about sort of supernatural figures, or was it just sort of the whole genre?
It was the whole genre. I mean, I remember particularly having a collection of illustrated fairy tales that really sort of fed my imagination. I also really enjoyed, and this may seem a little strange, but the stories of the Bible and reading stories in particular of the books of Daniel and Revelation, which are full of all kinds of transformations. So I don't suppose it's entirely that surprising that eventually I came around to be really interested in this discourse known as alchemy, in particular for the ways that it tests, I think, the limits of what is human, what is natural, and what is artificial.
So how did you become a specialist in your particular time period? I'm curious because these ideas are so central to sort of how humans imagine themselves as humans. You know, what does it mean to think about being human throughout history? So how, I mean, you have such a set of riches to pick from, you know, in terms of fantastic stories. How did you sort of become focused on the early modern period?
I mean, what you say is so true. I always think of Borges, Jean-Louis Borges, who said that there's only two stories in the world, and one is that of a man on the wine dark sea, and the other is that of a man on Golgotha. In other words, the Odyssey and the Bible. And so, yes, these kinds of stories are perennially favorite all the way up to our current fascination with Marvel Comics and perhaps Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So, I mean, certainly why the early modern period? I think part of it I would attribute to a couple of different things. This is a period to me that is very much in transition and in between ideas, between what we might think of as an older medieval world and what is going to become modernity, so the early modern period. And it's a period that is, I think, figuring out a lot of things. They haven't yet settled on the sort of taxonomies, what they call things. They're discovering things that they didn't believe once existed, now existed. Mm-hmm. Traveling around the globe, circumnavigation, and that these discoveries really increased and enhanced, I think, the bounds of their known world in ways that I find fascinating. But out of all of that perhaps rich historical moment, the author which stuck with me is Edmund Spenser, who is a British writer, but who spent much of his career writing in Ireland and wrote what some say is the longest poem in the English language. The Fairy Queen.
Right.
And I remember reading it on the bus while I was commuting to university and just became so fascinated with it and could not quite figure it out. And that kind of is what really drove my my turn probably towards studying that period.
Was that particular text. That's quite a, I hope our listeners out there realize what she has just said, because that's quite a story. Because if you just pick up The Fairy Queen, it's a hard text to read. And I would be shocked if everybody out there who's read The Fairy Queen, raise your hand, right? Okay, and I don't see a lot of hands being raised, maybe a little piece of it. I would be very curious what, if you could articulate for our listeners, what was such a powerful experience on the bus reading this particular piece of literature that it shaped so much of what became your intellectual desires. I did have a professor in college who liked to recite parts of that when I took an English class, and I will never forget that. But part of the power of the poem was with his professor, who had memorized large chunks of it. Other than that, I'm not sure it's the most obvious thing to jump off the page and into someone's mind, you know?
It depends on perspective, I suppose.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, I would just begin by saying I'm sort of flummoxed that someone would actually be able to memorize and recite parts of The Fairy Queen. So this is something that people will do with Paradise Lost, with Milton, yes. John Milton's text, to incredible sort of results. But there is something about the meter and the way that The Fairy Queen is written that I think actually encourages forgetfulness. And that thwarts attempts at easy sort of memorization. Mm-hmm. So this is a particularly challenging feat, I think, that your professor undertook to be able to memorize and recite bits of The Fairy Queen. For me, it was a challenge
yes.
because it is not a text which reveals itself in any kind of transparent way. It is also a text that if you read a canto a day, which is about usually a canto is anywhere between 55, sometimes 100 stanzas. Each stanza is 9 lines. If you read a canto a day consistently, there's a kind of cumulative effect to the reading that you get kind of lost in the world, that creates a kind of rhythm to the reading that's almost hypnotic. And I think that experience of breaking it down into this sort of consistent and manageable chunks, but also the serial nature of it in some ways. So if you end at the end of a canto, then you want to know what happens the next
right.
day.
You get drawn into the narrative story, and that's part of the power of the poetry.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful character in book 3, for those of you who have read it, for those of you who have not, you should, called Britomart, who's this amazing woman who falls in love with a knight in a mirror and goes in search of him. And to find him, she cross-dresses and becomes a knight and basically jousts with any knight that she encounters and usually wins. And so she was just also an amazingly fascinating sort of character for me.
So here you are enmeshed in the world of the Fairy Queen and asking these sort of questions about supernatural, the relationship of humans to supernatural figures. But in particular, what we're going to be talking about today is the relationship between humans, how they take their place in the natural world. And I think this is a very important question, I think, for today, for all of us to take a moment and think, how do we relate to the natural world? The story I like to give about this is when I ask my students, why don't we eat people? Why is cannibalism generally looked down at? Even though, of course, California has our famous Donner Pass story, but generally, and my students are sort of flummoxed and they sit there and think, why? And then one of the students raised her hand and she said, well, because I'm a vegetarian. She said, So it said something about how she sees herself fitting into the world of animals and how humans fit into the world of animals and then vegetable. But you're going to take us to some of the most complicated question, which is to the world of stone. How do we not relate to cuddly mammals, but how do we relate to stone? And in particular, to start us off with, how do we think about stone in relationship to sort of traditional alchemical ideas, which I'm sure that many of our listeners have heard of the term alchemy, but in particular, how do stones fit into sort of the traditional alchemical schema?
So I might begin at the end and work my way backwards, if that's okay, to sort of address the question of the relationship of alchemy to minerals and to stones in particular. And there's a couple of ways, I think, into that question. And one is simply that the sort of science, the early practice of alchemy was essentially the aim and goal to transmute metals, most traditionally base metals such as lead into gold. And the ultimate formula, what some people say is the stone that is no stone, is called the Philosopher's Stone. And that was the ultimate aim of most alchemical experiments, was to create this elixir, which could then transmute, whether that be a base metal like lead, or whether that even be, in some cases, disease, sickness, and sinful humans into a more purified form. So at the base, alchemy is a discourse which is concerned with metals and with minerals and their transformation. And I think that's quite fascinating, simply because we don't usually think of stone or minerals in particular as being things that are transformable. We tend to think of them as something that's solid. So when you say something is rock solid, typically what you mean is that it's not going anywhere, that it's something that's durable. And so there's this fascinating tension, I think, between invoking that which is seemingly the most enduring and the most stable of forms of matter as that which is also the most transformative.
Well, that idea of the complete transformability of the natural world, that you can kind of work the way up and down and transform anything, it would seem that humans and stones all... If that is your idea, that everything sort of has to take its place within that transformational capacity, and what you're saying then is there's nothing that isn't part, nature is basically transformation then, and there isn't anything that we would set apart as not participating in this overarching transformation.
Well, this is why I think alchemy is oftentimes a bit on the edge of a lot of different discourses, insofar as it troubles our ideas about stability. It troubles our ideas about stability of kind. It troubles our idea about the stability of the world around us in general. And in the early modern period, again, one of the reasons I think I find this period so interesting is that they are rethinking and reclassifying and retaxonomizing the natural world around them. And they've inherited a system of kingdoms, of knowledge, of the natural world that were influenced by Aristotle, that were also influenced by sort of biblical theories about there being a kind of ladder, a sort of scale of nature, they called it, where you would have at the base the kind of mineral realm, and you would move up to the vegetable realm. And then you would eventually sort of find the humans and then up into the divine realm. But what's interesting is that oftentimes that popularly called the chain of being has been seen as stable, as hierarchical, and as static. In other words, that there's a kind of place that you were expected to fit, and that's where you were. But if you go back and you look at someone like Pico della Mirandola, for example, who wrote the sort of English translation of the famous On the Dignity of Man. And in this, he's essentially sort of asking, what is the nature of man? And he begins with the recitation of the authorities who say, you know, man is a miracle. He is the sort of pinnacle of God's creation. And Pico does this really interesting thing where he flips that and he says, actually, we're not unusual because we are the apex, because we are the center of God's creation, but we're unusual in that we participate potentially in all of the other orders on the scale of nature. so that if we choose, we might become more brutish or mm-hmm. more plant-like, or we might even become stone-like,
uh-huh.
or we might, you know, ascend in the other direction and become more immaterial.
Right.
But in other words, there's this sense that the human is not distinct necessarily from the natural world around him or her, but is in fact very much enmeshed within this much more mm-hmm. vital universe. And I think what's really fascinating about that is that then even stone, even though it is seemingly at the bottom, can become something which is also the thing which can catalyze a sort of complete transformation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
That's quite familiar to me from the late antique period, because clearly they also believe that. And I think for my students, it's sometimes quite shocking to imagine a world in which humans are so much part of a, not a dichotomy, but this sort of spectrum of transformation. I mean, one of the things people talk about is, of course, gender as well, being a spectrum in which men and women had, you know, the one sex theory that men and women had the same genitalia. It's just there's a transformation by the women's genitalia goes inside. And if you act a certain way, you can become more like a woman. You act another way, you become more like a man. Certainly that's true within the religious system as well, that one can become divine. You can become more, work your way up into a more godly existence, and you can also work your way down. And I think in some ways it's hard to conceptualize such an incredibly transformational world in which the capacities are based on things that aren't less stable, exactly as you were saying. So we see that going up until the early modern period. That's sort of what you're saying, is that transformational capacity, how people act will sort of affect who they are, and that we are, we can go way down and we could go way up.
Exactly. And also, I think, and this is the other thing I find fascinating about looking into the imagery of alchemy and of stones, is that it's not just a kind of one-way vertical ladder. That, in other words, one of the things that emerges when you begin actually looking at how metaphors of stone are used,
mm-hmm.
that what you see is that stone is at the base, but it is also the point of origin. So there's a lot of origin myths that show humans coming out of stone, Deucalion and Pyrrha, for example, in Ovid, the story of Genesis of man being created out of clay. So that is an origin point, but it's not simply only at the base or at the bottom, but that you also find, for example, the idea of the heavenly afterlife as being one which is imagined taking place in the New Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
which of course is a city of magnificent, beautiful stone.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, that you have stone at the bottom where we might expect to find it, but that you also find it in these most exalted forms as well. So that there's not a simple matter of being dull like a stone, but mm-hmm. that there is also a way in which the stony can also become a point of transformation to be achieved
mm-hmm.
through these different kinds of cyclical forms of regeneration.
So just to clarify that for us, do you think that other things, when we look back at this world, it was quite different from ours, in which things turned into things, people could become divine, and there was this tremendous capacity for people to move their place within the natural world. Do you think that it was just stone that was sort of at the bottom and then again at the top, as you say, in this kind of very interesting way? Or do you think everything was sort of, I mean, once you have this transformational system, it's very hard to contain it in a way. You know, it's sort of like everything. I mean, and I think also my students find this confusing, that everything sort of turns into everything then, you know, that there's no kind of systematicity to it. So or are you saying there's something special about the role of stones in the hierarchy here?
I mean, I think there is a plasticity more generally applicable and possible, both in sort of poetic and in natural philosophy in the period. So, for example, you think about Ovid's Metamorphoses. You wonder sometimes if they ever will end, that there does seem to be.
Because they keep transforming over and over and over again.
That there's this kind of endless possibility of transformation.
Yes, yes.
At the same time, and I think this is where that sort of classical strain intersects quite interestingly with religious ideas, there is that bumps up against ideas of sort of clear boundaries and of kind of clear delineations between different types of humans, different forms of believers, for example. But what I find interesting is that within those narratives, it's oftentimes Stone, which becomes, and you'll have to forgive the puns as they begin to proliferate, but it becomes a touchstone for these particular kinds of transformations, or conversely, an urge to really delineate or to set a boundary between you and someone else. So, for instance, one of the favorite terms of abuse in the period was to accuse someone else of being stony-hearted.
Yes,
and
very bad.
The implication of being stony-hearted was that there was something about you which was not entirely fully human.
Mm.
So, in other words, stones become both interesting cases of boundary setting, even at the same time, I think, as that urge to delineate a boundary suggests an anxiety about the possibility that the boundaries that we're setting are not entirely natural, but mm-hmm. arbitrary.
So you said you were interested in the early modern period because you felt that this was a time in which so many things were being rethought. And it's always good to be working at a time when a lot of things are being rethought. I mean, that's a pretty exciting time to study. So can you help us understand a little bit then, if we see this as sort of being the classical heritage of alchemy in which you can make fantastic transformations that are ultimately possibly limitless, though presumably once you do the transformation, the ultimate transformation, you don't want to go back and do it over again, but this very this capacity to transform things over and over again, when that then bumps up against the early modern period, what kinds of changes are we looking at in the terms of way people thought with these sort of natural images?
So, I mean, I think, again, a part of my being drawn specifically to this period in history is very much bound up with the momentous changes that were happening in religion. And mm-hmm. England, quite famously, has a very recursive tract through its various reformations, swinging back and forth between a Catholic faith and various versions of Protestantism or Anglicanism. So that these questions, and oftentimes at the heart of so many of these both liturgical practices as well as sort of questions of faith and belief and identity, are bound up with these questions of where you fit into the natural world.
Yes.
And so I think that as you begin to question things like the nature of the Eucharist, the nature of transformation in general, mm-hmm. that then is going to open up a lot of things to question and to scrutiny that before might have been less contentious subjects. So I think the religious Reformation is very much sort of bound up with these ideas of the changing natural world.
So in other words, what you're saying is that with each Reformation, humans have to rethink what does it mean to be human in the natural world? What is their relationship with the natural world? Because there was a way in which that you just didn't worry about it before, and now everything is sort of open for a question.
Well, my medievalist friends will say that's never entirely true, that there were always, you know, these smaller sort of reformations that happened consistently and led to questioning, and that is true. But there is something, I think, that becomes more systemic particularly with Henry VIII's break with Rome that brings about great liturgical and practical changes to the life of every Englishman across the century. So that I think there is something specifically systematic about this moment which might set it apart from some of the earlier iterations of these questions.
Mm. So we see that these questions being opened up. So if you could characterize for us your point of view of, you know, how do you fit the Reformation in then? Is it about the fact that there was just so many things up for grabs that one was basically rethinking the very nature of the questions that how did this open up stones again? How did it open up stones in some way that gave the opportunity to sort of rethink over again? I understand the transformation. You're not going to give up on transformation, presumably. But you are going to, it would seem, do some kind of basic rethinking about transformation in nature.
Well, and I think a part of what's at stake here is identity, right? So my first book was looking at the way that the modes of storytelling changed as a result of the various reformations in England. And I had looked a lot at the impact of religious discourse on the kinds of stories that were told. And I thought I had left behind some of those questions around religious change when I became interested, particularly in stones. But what the metaphor which specifically set me on this path or on this trail came from a favored term of abuse that was slung on both sides of the aisle by both Catholics as well as Puritans, or the hotter sort of Protestants, as we call them, that if you were ungodly, that you possessed a heart of stone.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I became really interested in how that implied these categories of ontology.
Right.
And along with that, if you were no longer considered a human, then you might be relegated outside the realms of the kinds of protections and laws which are given to humans. Therefore, if you are someone who is a non-believer, one of the ungodly, you don't deserve or you don't merit necessarily the same kinds of treatment as mm-hmm. someone who is one of the godly. And so it became a really popular way to cast, you know, to sort of like castigate your opponent.
The worst thing
that you could say about them. But what happens, and I think this is what's really interesting, is that in the process of doing that, they ended up sort of creating a category which may or may not have actually been as common as they thought it was, simply through the naming of it. And there's a part of me that thinks there's something about the fact of using stone that gives it a kind of monumentality through its sense of having a fixity that emerges in that. And so that specific epithet is what kind of drove me into thinking a little bit more about the ways that stone is both used to create identity, but also to anxiously kind of shore it up.
So that what you're saying is that, you know, if you follow the early modern term of abuse, you know, you have a heart of stone, that's a complicated way of talking about another human being. That on the one hand, it puts them outside of the realm of humanness, because we see stone as being in some way antithetical to what does it mean to be a human. So on the one hand, you're kind of expelling them from the family of man, so to speak. But you're also saying that you're also making them immortal, right? You're making them incredibly powerful, mm-hmm. you know, longevity they have, mm-hmm. that you're not reducing them in some ways to call somebody, and to really use this as a characterization that you are a person of stone, is to give a great deal of power to them.
Exactly. It's exactly right. And also, I think, you know, sort of somewhat conversely, is that you're opening up the potential of their transformation, and you are suggesting that there is something perhaps stone-like in every human that can be potentially denigrated or potentially transformed. So that one of the sort of searching questions is, how do you transform your heart of stone into one of flesh? But that assumes...
Well, tell us, how do you do that? I mean, in case there's anybody out there that's getting particularly stony, I mean, do they talk about how to melt stone or transform stone? I mean, presumably that's what they've been searching to do for generations in terms of standard alchemical technique. So now they apply that to stony hearts?
That's exactly right. There's some wonderful emblem books that are... It's called Scala Cordis, and it's a series of emblems which portray the various trying of the human heart. And you have both pictures as well as poems accompanying these I might call them tortures, that the human heart goes through in order to move from being one that is unresponsive and unresistant to one that is pliable and fleshly. And they include everything from there's images of angels with tongs throwing a burning heart into the fire. What look like alchemical bellows, sort of heating the furnace to get it nice and hot so that the heart is burned. It's hit with a mallet. There's a variety of sort of tests that it undergoes. But this is also, as you can see, a way of dealing with tribulation and suffering.
Yes.
Seeing it as something which is transformative in terms of a spiritual regeneration and renewal.
Because presumably... everybody, well, I don't, it might be a little bit broad, but many people have the feeling that their heart is in the fire, or that their heart is under some mallet, or those kinds of experiences as being sort of just another way of thinking about what does it mean to be a human and to suffer.
That's absolutely correct. And that somehow this recourse to thinking about the human heart, not simply as a kind of transient sort of fleshly thing, but also something which is imbued with the kind of stability and transformability that was thought to adhere to a metal life or to a mineral life, is one which also potentially brings about a great renewal.
So I'm just struck is that it all sounds rather violent, you know, in terms of it doesn't seem to be the idea that you transform. I mean, the alchemical imagery is quite violent, and you don't transform through love. You know, it's not like a, you know, a hand-holding weekend where you go out into the natural world and look at the sunset. It is quite technically, you know, destructive implements and technically transformational things like fire. And so I don't know. That seems quite striking to me in terms of the way in which one connects both, you know, feelings, the we're talking about people's feelings, but also to, you know, a very... it's just very technically strenuous and, as you say, kind of torturous sounding way of dealing with something that is also quite intimate and human.
Yeah, I mean, the process of alchemical keys or phases and steps often involves the breaking down and the dissolution and even passing through a stage of sort of decay and then potentially regeneration. And that is not a process that is peaceful. It is very violent. And so you think, for instance, of some of the poetry of John Donne. Mm-hmm. So most famously, one of his holy sonnets, "Batter My Heart, You Three-Personed God."
Yes.
This is a poem which is about an attempt by the speaker to connect with a divine form of love. And the language that he uses is often quite shocking.
Yes.
And quite violent. But you can see when you begin to sort of understand in some ways the discourse of alchemy, how that violent breaking apart, that being burned, that being sort of subject to these violent processes are in fact the necessary means by which the soul or the metal is purified. Mm-hmm. So that the suffering, again, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the stony heart, that the suffering is a necessary part in some ways of becoming human.
Because you aren't really human. And to make something human, to humanize, is not an easy thing to do. And it's not a sunny, funny thing to do. To humanize something, to take something that is inhuman stone and give it all the feelings and softness, presumably, and all that of human, is going to take some pretty heavy-handed interventions here.
And
we're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's a part of the agony, right, that you find in a lot of the religious poetry of the period, including writers like George Herbert, Richard Crashaw, as well as John Donne, that the path to salvation and their sort of understanding of religion is not an easy one.
Not an easy one. Well, on that note, we are going to take, we have finished the first half of
on
the show.
On a happy note.
Yes, on the of torturing ourselves into being truly loving human beings. We're going to take a quick break and we will be back for the second half of Office Hour today with Tiffany Jo Wirth and more on alchemy. So stay with us. So welcome back. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we're here for the second half today of our show, and we're talking about people's conception of their relationship to the natural world. How do you think you fit into the natural world? I think that's a really good question for every listener to think about as we talk about alchemy and how people in the early modern period saw themselves. We were just talking about having a stony heart and all of the agony you had to go through in order to make yourself from a person of stone in the transformation and to be a person of presumably truly loving human person. And now another way of talking about stones, I want to make sure we get a little bit of chance to talk about this, is you have some wonderful articles about particular stones that seem to loom large in human society, that we put stones up literally on a pedestal. Is that too much of a pedestal on a pedestal? And somehow, even though you'd think of stones as being quite mute, they somehow take on a fairly large role in the imagination. And the one you talk about, I love this example, is the London Stone, from which is now in London. And presumably, if our listeners went to London, they could see it in London. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. And it's a stone that actually isn't really that important, except you say it's like Paris Hilton. It's famous for being famous. In other words, once the stone started to get famous, you couldn't make it unfamous again. You can't take the fame away from the stone. It became a literal sort of monumental embodiment of something about London, per se? And this happened in the early modern period. Is that correct?
Well, London Stone goes back further.
Even further than that.
I believe it's 1142 when it first enters the historical record. It's right around there. So in other words, 12th century is when we begin to encounter it in the written record. And it's really fascinating, I think, because oftentimes we think of jewels, crown jewels. We think of these kinds of stones as being emblematic of important power systems, of royalty, of the identity of a monarchy. But I became really interested in some of these lesser known stones that aren't very enigmatic. So we kind of began this conversation with talking about the fact that stone may lack the qualities of the sort of, I'm thinking of megafauna, you know, charismatic megafauna like pandas or something like that, that naturally make us want to sit up and watch. But I became really interested in these stones, which seemingly have no allure. They're not beautiful.
They don't do much.
They're sort of there. And yet the layers and layers of stories, which begin to sort of grow up around them. And we can talk about London Stone, but another famous stone, of course, is the Stone of Destiny, which is now back in Scotland. But so London Stone is quite fascinating because it is just this really like unremarkable hunk of rock. It's about the size of a microwave. And it has resided at its place in Cannon Street for as long as, again, going back to the 12th century. And there's a lot of legends which have grown up around this stone. Some say that it is the actual heart of London. So if you follow sort of psychogeographers or if you follow fantasy writers like China Mieville, there's a real interest in this stone as somehow being emblematic of the city itself. And there's proverbs about it being the moment when London Stone is moved, London itself will fall. This was one of the prophecies that emerged in the 19th century.
And nobody wants to take a chance with that one.
So, but it's quite fascinating because it actually has been moved recently. So throughout the burning of London, through various bombings, it survived its place on Cannon Street in London and was housed in a sort of unprepossessing little grill inside of a building which was a bank. And then it was bought out by a new corporation, and the stone was briefly moved to the British Museum and spent a little bit of time there. Nothing earth-shattering happened, so far as we know, so perhaps the myths aren't true, although it may have been 2016 when it was moved, so who knows. But this stone, again, there's nothing about it which would draw attention. And yet it appears in chronicles of the city as the place, the kind of symbolic place for what represents London. So, for instance, in Shakespeare plays, we have a wonderful story of Jack Cade, who launched a rebellion, and he signaled and seemed to have achieved his rebellion when he sat upon London Stone. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is a short-lived victory, and not long after that, he is hung from the tower. And so there's something slightly treacherous about London Stone, that it is both something which can give power, or confer authority or legitimacy, at the same time that it seemingly has an agenda which is beyond that of humankind in its longevity.
Because it can make alliances. The stone can make alliances with different forces that we may not be able to control, who the stone throws itself in with.
That's exactly right. And there's some wonderful anonymous early lyrics in the 16th century that tell of it falling in love with a local water conduit. And it tells this sort of wonderful story about this wedding feast at which all of the sort of Londoners are invited to attend, and the stone and the water conduit dance in joy.
So help us understand this. Why is this stone so taken such a place in the imagination? Much like it's not exactly a supernatural figure of the type that you would, you know, when you were reading your children as growing up with fairy tales. It's not as appealing as a fairy or something like that. So what is so appealing about a stone?
That is a question I've been asking myself for quite a few years now. What is so charismatic about a stone that draws us back again and again to think about them and to sort of ruminate on them? The other example that I will give, and maybe this is a part of an answer, is the Stone of Destiny, which is the stone upon which traditionally the Scottish monarchy were coronated,
right.
And then it was brought down into England and resided in Westminster, and a special shelf built for it under the throne on which monarchs were crowned until very recently. And it was a legend that somehow this stone was that which conveyed a kind of authority to the monarch who sat upon it. So I'm sure we could tease out the ways again in which stone is seen to be enduring and which stone is seen to sort of confer some kind of legitimacy.
Right.
But in other words, there is a way in which if we suture ourselves to the identity of a stone, we are also monumentalized or commemorated.
Yes, yes.
I think of, for example, Mount Rushmore, to think of a more contemporary example in the United States, where you have faces carved on a mountain, which become their own kind of draw and longevity in some ways for the figures whom they represent. So I'm wondering if a part of the allure or the appeal of stone is in many ways perhaps our desire to find a kind of more enduring longevity or to find some sort of endurance. And this is something that there's a medieval critic, Jeffrey Jerome Cohen, who has written wonderfully about this in a book called Stone and Ecology of the Inhuman. And one of the things that he does try to tease out is what is this relationship that we have to stone. He's also written on diamonds and why it is that diamonds have become a symbol of love and engagement and why we spend so much for them.
Yeah, slightly similar ways. I mean, it's interesting that he calls it the unhuman because, I mean, when I think of possible ways, and our listeners may have their own free associations at this moment, what are they thinking about in relationship to stone? But I think about it as bone, one thing to do with sort of the connection to bone. Bones are a part of human beings. We are that lasts a little bit longer than some of the other parts of us. Mm-hmm. So an identification with that parts of us which seem to, and as we move towards a recycling theory of life and, you know, the new ideas about being buried, the bones will be the part that does last, that is a little bit more immortal than maybe blood being something that goes the fastest. I don't know whether you think that's lurking in there.
I think it is. And I think, again, if we go back to the Ovidian story of Deucalion and Pyrrha, which I'll just briefly recap for listeners if they're not familiar with it. The story is of Deucalion and Pyrrha, who after the flood find themselves the only humans left. And they pray to Venus and they beg to Venus to help them repopulate the earth. And the instructions are that they take the bones of their mother and throw them over their shoulder. And they can't figure that out. They're trying to think, what are the bones of our mother? And then they begin to reason, oh, well, they must be the stones or the bones of the earth. That must be. So if we take the stones and throw them over our shoulders, they may spring up into a race of humans, which is what happens. And the English translation of Ovid says, oh, we are a stony race indeed.
Yes.
So in other words, there is a real connection here between stones as the bones of the earth and the bones of humans as somehow sharing a kinship.
Mm-hmm. Though it's interesting, he does call that unhuman, in that maybe we want to see something that is different. In other words, in this moment, we're trying to emphasize that humans play a role in a system, a natural system, in which some parts of the natural world are very different from us. We are not the measure in this way. A diamond is the measure of something that a human is not. So we've conferred a high symbolic value on things that feel very far off from being humans.
That's right. And I think, again, that's what becomes so fascinating, is that stones are both boundary and also portal. So they are that which separate, but also somehow that which draw us in or sort of connect us. So I really love to think of the example of Jacob's ladder and Jacob's dream from the Old Testament, where he falls asleep and has a dream with his head on a stony pillow. And it's the dream which, or rather it's the stone which facilitates the dream, because that is the portal through which he then views a ladder ascending to heaven with angels going up and down on it. So in other words, it is both that which is distinct and inhuman, but yet that also somehow which the boundary, which is permeable. And I think it's that tension that makes it so compelling.
Well, it's a complicated tension, again, because we do have bones and they do last a little bit longer, but they don't last forever. So they also decay. And I think about that in terms of, for example, burial mechanisms we had in the late antique period where the flesh would rot off the bones and then the bones would be regathered. And so there was kind of a notion of the stages of transformation into the world of death. I'm very curious, step back from all of these really interesting ideas and think a little bit about their echoes today. When I was reading over your articles about the importance of stones, I thought about the eggheads on campus. Now, I don't know whether or not you've ever thought about them in that kind of way. It's very interesting to me that the eggheads are both a very fragile thing, which is an egghead. What could be more fragile than our head? And then what could be more fragile than an egghead by definition? And it has that kind of fleshiness looking towards it. On the other hand, they're absolutely sort of permanent. So they're also our kind of wish to be both. I mean, I see those as kind of being in that Freudian way that you can have your wish and eat it too sometimes, where you can be both the most fragile thing and the most permanent thing, and that art permits us to have those moments where we as humans can point to ourselves and say, look, we're incredibly fragile, but we're also immortal at the same time.
It's funny that you mentioned the egghead. So I'm a recent implant, I suppose you could say, perhaps at UC Davis. And when I came to visit and do my campus visit, one of the things that I was proudly shown as one of the features of campus were the eggheads.
Yes.
So in other words, those have become iconic.
Yes.
And I think that this is one of the allures, again, of stone, is that it can become these iconic landmarks around which we then suture an identity. So a part of being an Aggie and being at UC Davis, right, is you know the story of the eggheads, and you kind of go around, you look at them and you laugh at them, and they're kind of ugly and they're kind of funny, but they are resonant and have become symbolic in many ways with UC Davis. Mm-hmm. And I think the reasons that you've suggested are very resonant and also perhaps part of our psychological attachment and the reason why they become such enduring pieces in our imagination.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that have we come very far from the early modern period in terms of our attitudes towards stone, or are we just sort of at this point sort of recycling sort of classic imagery about stone from the early modern period? If you saw that as a period of change, are we in another lithic period of change? Are we in a big period in which we as humans are rethinking ourselves? And are doing that partly by rethinking our relationship to stone right now?
I mean, I think so. That's a very big question.
Yes,
but I might begin with a more glib answer, which is to say that in some ways we may look back at the furor around the moving of London Stone. We might sort of laugh at the attachment to the Stone of Destiny. We might laugh at the importance of stone altars in churches. But a lot of these debates still spark controversy. So there's been a lot of controversy, for example, around whether or not the Stone of Destiny will be brought back out of Scotland for the next monarch to be crowned on.
Right now in Scotland.
So in other words,
that's fighting words. Words of stone about stones are fighting words.
These things. And when London Stone was moved, there was a lot of popular pieces around what that meant and what it potentially signified, which in many ways suggested the same kinds of fascination that I see in the early modern period with these objects. So that, in other words, I think that even though we think of ourselves as perhaps being in a modern secular world, we still have these attachments to lithic objects that are not entirely explainable. Mm-hmm. So I think that's at least one answer to your question. The other answer, perhaps a bigger sort of philosophical question about our own moment in questioning what it means to be human, is one in which we are finding ourselves consistently augmented by technology.
Yes.
And I think it's quite fascinating if you think about the fact that most of our phones, for example, run on silicon, right? So that, in other words, we are still, in many ways, augmenting, continuing, supplementing our human selves with various kinds of mineral additions and add-ons that aren't so different, perhaps, in some ways, from a knight putting on armor and becoming a stronger, faster, more resilient human. So in other words, I think that stones tie into a lot of our current questions around digital technologies and what it means to supplement and augment human abilities with other forms.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a very good point. And when I ask my students sort of about identity terms of self-identification. You know, do they consider themselves humans, men, Americans, you know, religious figures? There's a lot of choices. I have a number that would now consider themselves to be cyborgs, that they have, in fact, changed what it means to be human, and they now see themselves as being partially human and partially something that's not human, that has now, in fact, been added to their own body. And just as you were saying, that they, in fact, have incorporated their phones and their other things, and that they are actually limbs.
If we bring this back to alchemy, one of the things that vexed early practitioners was, how could you tell the difference between alchemical gold and natural gold?
Uh-huh.
And did it matter? And I think those are similar questions that you're raising around, at what point does someone no longer become a human, and does that matter?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that that's both, again, the fascination and perhaps the revulsion with something like alchemy, is that it's hard to know or had to test where the line is between something that is natural and something that is artificial, and
right.
whether or not that fundamentally changes mm-hmm. the ontology.
And if we see these stone things as being another part of nature, maybe incorporating other parts of nature into ourselves is not as unnatural as it might seem. You know, in other
exactly.
words, you know, having a phone
exactly.
is actually not an unnatural thing. It's a form of an extension, a transformation back to the old classical notion that how do you transform yourself? Now, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't have to be by beating yourself over the head mm-hmm. with a mallet. It's a much more beautiful transformation that way. You simply extend your capability. I'm also wanted to just ask you again about this, the lure that this material had for you when you're young. And I want to return to that briefly at the end now, because I do think the question of the supernatural is so powerful. And I wonder whether the students do see themselves as being more supernatural figures because they have their phones. You know, is there a form of enchantment that comes and they have the eggheads and they have all of these other things that in a way it give them the capacity to transcend human limits? Because who wants to be a human being all the time? You know, you want to have this supernatural, and that maybe fairies is not really the model now, that maybe our notion of how we incorporate and enchant the natural world is quite, in fact, quite different than even it was maybe just a couple of decades ago.
And here we come back to the double-edged nature of London Stone. You think it's going to give you all of the power and all of the glamour and all of the authority that you need, but it's treacherous. And I think of recent studies, I'm thinking of the New Dark Ages, for instance, which suggest that perhaps some of our technologies are, in fact, making us dumber and less able to be the kind of adaptive species that we have been. And so I think that in a similar way, what you're talking about with these sort of augmentations is that there's aspects of it which are amazing, but that there is also potentially a darker side to that. In the ways in which it may ultimately make us more dependent mm-hmm. rather than independent.
Well, I would say, in my understanding, having spending quite a bit of time around this generation of the people with their two or three different ways in which they're, you know, connected, is maybe it's not making them, I don't know whether it's making them dumber, but I do wonder what it's doing in terms of their notion to the limitations of the human versus the supernatural. I don't see these as being supernaturally exciting or elevating. It doesn't seem to be feeding the imagination. So I'm sort of interested in the difference between a stone, which doesn't do very much, somehow being able to give us a lot of imagination, you know, and a phone, which does a whole lot of much more sophisticated things, but yet may not be the source of a lot of imagination. And that you want to read stories, and we want to read stories more about these stones than we could see our phones being magical characters in stories that we tell, somehow giving us a new vision of what it means to be human being. So as the stone expert, I just want to sort of ask you that then, what, you know, how come stones are just so good for the imagination and, you know, complicated technological things don't seem to be so good?
I mean, I think you've hit it squarely when you say that a part of it is the seemingly blankness and the ductility, so that you can project in some ways whatever you want on it in terms of your imagination. And rather than being simply one thing, the blankness opens up to a whole canvas of different kinds of emotions. I think this is one of the reasons why in the sonnets, for example, the sonneteers often refer to their women as sort of stony women, in part because that's what becomes their imaginative canvas.
Mm-hmm. They can imagine that stony woman anyway. And then they can also imagine, you know, what they might have to do to make love work along with that all. Well, maybe the moral here is that students should carry around a case for a phone without a phone in it, you know.
No. Bring back the pet rocks.
Bring back the pet rocks. Okay. So I don't know if there's any sort of thought question you want to leave our listeners with today at the end of our investigation of stoniness. Maybe that's it. Maybe that somehow carrying a rock in your pocket, it doesn't have to be painted. It doesn't have to have the word peace on it. But it can be a tool for imagination and therefore a tool for reimagining yourself as a human being.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I guess maybe my last sort of thought question or thing that I would like to pose is simply also, why is it that there's something incredibly erotic and sexual and sexy about stones? Why is it that somehow that becomes something that's also attractive?
That's a great thought to end with. Okay, so that pet rock in your pocket can also be very, very, very erotic. And have you thought about that recently? I think that's a great note to end on. So I want to thank Tiffany Jo Wirth very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and you'll be able to listen to the show and our other archives on officehourucdpodcast.com. And tune in next week. We will knock on someone else's door. And in the meantime, you know, put a stone in your pocket and think about all the different meanings. We've talked about that for today. So, okay. And we'll be back next week. Meantime, stay tuned for Radio Theater. Bye.